Good morning. You girls are rowdy. I like it. I've spoken here a few times, and one of the things you have in common is your coordinator is always funny. Was that your coordinator who was up here talking about not wanting to play with the kids? Was that you, baby? I just want you to know. Okay, well, whoever, what's your name? Amy, you're funny. I was in the back going, woo! I have two girls, and so I found that the only game, I got so tired of pretending to be the prince that kissed them while they were sleeping, which really is not a sign of consent and isn't really a good idea to teach your kids that. I got so tired of that, my favorite game with my kids was beauty parlor, which meant I'm going to lay down and you're going to pretend to put makeup on me and play with my hair. That worked out really well. So if I could get my first slide up, that'd be great. I like to always start with MOPS groups. If you've heard me just telling you that I loved MOPS so much and it saved my life and reason, but I hated it when speakers would come and say, treasure this time. Because this is the most precious time of mothering and what you will miss most when your kids get older. And I would always think that is bad news. It's going to get worse. I love babies. I really enjoyed being pregnant the first time. Can I get an amen? It's harder the second time because you have to take care of a child at the same time. But the stage that I'm in is so much easier than what you're doing. I bring these pictures because this is me when my daughter was 9 months old and my other one was four. And it's, go back, it was Easter Sunday and I just look so stinking tired. And then here I am with my kids as they're grown and they're so fun. I have a 15-year-old daughter who is one of my favorite people in the world. And so when people tell you, oh, you're screwed when your kids are teenagers, you know what? That's not necessarily true. It's really fun. And my kids go to bed and they stay in their bed all night long. And they put on their own shoes and their own clothes and they pack their own lunches. And if they have to throw up, they go to the toilet and they don't do it in their bed or in my car. You're so close to that. Isn't that worth it? Just to know that you won't have to change vomit sheets anymore? So we're almost there. Today we're going to talk about the fact that all my friends have issues. I don't have perfect friends. My friends have problems, and I have problems. And so we're going to talk about what it looks like to be in safe relationships with women and how to kind of adjust the risk that we all have that's inherent to friendships. Next slide. Sometimes you just need another woman around. Let's start with that. And you need a mom, right? You need other moms around. That's why I love MOPS. This is my friend Jenny. She's my neighbor. She's not grabbing my bottom. I don't know exactly what's happening in that picture. But she and I are neighbors, and she has two children, I have two children, and we like to do things together as families occasionally. And so one time we went out to dinner, this was several years ago, but we went out to dinner at a Mexican restaurant, and we had all our food, and Jenny and I and our kids were together, and our husbands were off at the soda fountain across the restaurant, and my oldest, who at the time was 11, bit into a carnitas taco and started to scream because the hot fat was dripping down her arm and burning her. And I thought, I looked around and there was no napkins, and so I just went. And my daughter looked at me like, what did you just do? And I looked at Jenny, and I'm like, was that weird? And she said, no, if she was my kid, I would have licked her. You know, it makes total sense. And so my husband came back to the table, and we told him what happened, and he said, why would you do that? I said, well, there weren't any napkins. And he said, well, why didn't you use your hand? Well, that hadn't even occurred to me. Because I'm a mother, and you need another mother to understand that if your child is being scalded by animal fat, you use the most soothing thing at your disposal, and that is your wet pink tongue. You don't even think about it. My husband is a great guy. We've been married 20 years this July, and he's so glad that I have other people to talk to. He likes the day that I'm speaking because I might be quieter when he gets home. Next slide. Friendships are risky. When you join a MOPS group or walk into a group of women, you always kind of wonder, It's not just you. What if nobody likes me? Or what if I don't like anybody? What if I don't find anyone to relate to? I would guarantee that the things that have hurt you most in your life have been relationships. Someone who didn't love you back or didn't love you well or hurt your feelings. And that is the reality of relationships, is we will get hurt in relationships. And this is on your outline. I don't know if you guys have outlines. I'm terrible about remembering to tell you to fill in the blanks. So if you're OCD and I miss one, please wave frantically at me and I will tell you what the blank is. But the first is that friendships are risky. But the second thing is I also believe that friendships are where we find safety. I Googled this proverb. I found it on the internet and it says, don't protect yourself by a fence, but rather by your friends. And we can be tempted in all different ways to put up walls between us and other people, to have fences to protect us, emotional boundaries or time spent away from people to hide. But having safe relationships can protect us from the outside world. Having safe relationships are one of the places that we can find acceptance and unconditional love and just people that will get us and hear us at our most raw. And one of my best friends calls it being each other's emotional historian. Someone who's there to hear you in your moments and be able to help you process your reality. And that's a great, safe reality. Here are some of my friends. We're going to go through their issues one at a time, okay? They love that joke. Above all else, love each other deeply, for love covers a multitude of sins. That's my favorite Bible verse on relationships. And I love, it was the MOPS international theme verse a few years ago. And because you know what? Authenticity is risky. Because every single one of these women has hurt my feelings. And I have hurt each one of their families. And we've had to have apologies and back and forth and negotiating of the relationship to stay friends. But these are really precious people to me. And God's done something weird in my life. Let me tell you their names. This is Jenny, Josie, Jody, Jana, Gina, Joe, Jenny, and Jill. I call them my J's, and my book is dedicated to my J's. Because these are the women that have stood with me through a lot of stuff. One of them is my college roommate. Two of them are my neighbors, two of them I met in MOPS, and one is my very best friend in the world that I met in a couple's Bible study 19 years ago when we were newlyweds. And we've been through a lot of crap together. And these are the women that showed up to dance with me on my 40th birthday, which is my most memorable birthday. I had a hoedown in my brother's backyard, and none of them like country music, and they came and I taught them to line dance anyway. Now that's a good friend. But when I look at this picture, there's someone missing in this picture. And it was one of my dearest friends that I made in MOPS. And about 4 years ago, she and I broke up. Anyone ever had a friendship breakup? And I see that she's not in this picture. And I have been teaching this lesson for 7 years in various forms. And when she and I broke up, I thought, that's it. I can't teach on this anymore. I've lost my best friend. And now I feel God is continuing to encourage me that this is why I can teach on this. Because the reality is, I was in an unsafe relationship with that friend. It wasn't good for either of us. And some of the things I'm going to teach you today are things I learned from losing that friendship. And you can know that I'm in this with you. That sometimes relationships are really difficult and they don't always work out. On that depressing note, next slide. My friend Jana, one of my J's, she and I met in MOPS, and we both struggled with chronic anxiety and depression. I was diagnosed with postpartum depression. I spoke on that, I think, a couple of years ago here, and I felt bad because no one likes to talk about depression on their MOPS day, but it's very important. But Jana and I had both been really overcoming it, learning a lot, doing really well, but then our church offered a boot camp. They called it Anxiety and Depression Boot Camp. And it was a 6-week class where you could go and learn battle tools to fight chronic anxiety and depression. So we're like, well, we should go. We could still learn things and we'll go together. And because what if we go and there's like 4 depressed people in the room and we want someone to support us? So we show up at the workshop and there's over 150 people in the room, men and women. 1 in 4 women in this country will take antidepressants in the course of their life. Did you know that? And most of them are between the ages of 25 and 40, the time that we're being told to treasure. That is our most precious time. But anxiety is a real thing. So we went to this boot camp, and on the second night, we had a great lecturer, but he caused me anxiety, which is not what you want in anxiety boot camp. he said, one of the best tools you have in your arsenal against mental health crisis is a network of safe, sane friends. Jana and I look at each other. I'm crazy and you're crazy and that's why we're here. That's why we're friends. My friends and I joke that mutual craziness is like what we have in common. And I'm in the workshop and I start flashing back as he's talking to like the last time I went to a coffee with my friend Jenny. And it was like, if you were at the next table, you would have thought, well, this is like a counseling session with two patients and no doctor. You know what I'm saying? Like, we're just like hashing out all this stuff that's going on with our families and why and the possible childhood origins and who we're frustrated with and all this stuff that's going on. And I realize in this session, my friends have issues. Among us, we have some codependency, some irrational fear, some obsessive-compulsive disorder. We have trouble setting boundaries with our kids, with our mother-in-laws, and occasionally with our husbands. Some of us are compulsively early. Some of us are chronically late, which is a sign of bad boundaries. Some of us can't order from menus because we just can't make decisions. And there's just all kinds of stuff going on in our lives. And so I think, what am I going to do? I'm just overcoming depression. I can't go out and find a whole bunch of new friends. And what do I have to offer? Like, hi, my therapist said I need a safe friend. Can you please take me? When I get better, maybe I can help you. You know, and that was kind of where I was at. That all happened in like a 5-minute period inside my head. And then the lecturer began to define his terms. And this came from a wonderful book by Cloudon Townsend called Safe People. And this is on your outline. He said, this is the qualities of safe, sane friends. The number one is that they are honest. The second is that they are willing to admit their own faults. And there's a little asterisk in there that I added, especially in the context of conflict. Can someone admit that they're wrong when they've hurt you? They're able to both give and take from the relationship, so there's a mutuality. I'm not here to fix you, and you're not here to fix me, but how can we support each other mutually? And they're interested in personal growth. So basically, the world is not divided into people with issues and people without issues, but people who can admit they have issues and people who won't or who can't or who don't want to. And I breathe a sigh of relief because what my best friends have in common is self-awareness. These are women who are interested in knowing the truth about themselves and are willing to share it with others. I feel privileged, actually, that I know my friends have issues because that means they tell me the truth about themselves, that we are intimate enough that I know them, that I know their profound strengths and what they struggle with. And they do have profound strengths, but self-awareness is the number one. So I want to break down a couple of these terms because you're all like, I know what those things mean, but I want to break them down a little bit. And the first is, what does it really mean to be honest? And I want to say that honest equals, oh, I'm sorry, next slide. I think there's an extra one in here now. Okay, so honest people. Honest equals a lifestyle of transparency. We hear a lot about authenticity in our culture, don't we? And I think we're all kind of looking for that. Oh, she's so real. You know, we hear people that are so real. But real doesn't just mean your struggles, but you're also real about your strengths. You're a transparent person. So the first thing is, honest people act truthfully. So if you run into me at Target, I really hope that I would seem like the same person that I am here on stage. Psychologists call that an integrated person. I don't have to change my personality or wear different masks for different people. I can just be myself. I was at a soccer field. I live in Irvine, but my daughter was playing in honors soccer. My other daughter's in honor. I have two kids. My brain isn't fully back yet. I'm sorry to give you the bad news, but I haven't regained all of my cognitive abilities since having children. My daughter was playing an all-star soccer game in San Clemente, which is quite far away from, you know, my hometown, and it was quite a brutal game, and the refs were not doing a good job. And so as I was leaving, someone called out, Amanda! I'm like, I don't know anyone here. They must be calling. Amanda! And I turn around, and she goes, you spoke at my mops group. And I'm like, did I yell at the ref? She's like, no, you're walking the walk, girl. It was good. I'm like, whew, because I might have said some swear words because I was frustrated. But like, are we really who we say we are in every situation? I had a girlfriend that I was really close to in MOPS many years ago, like 10 years ago. And we were seriously dating, if you know what I'm saying. Like, we had a 3-day-a-week phone call, you know, like we were going to talk on the phone at least 3 days a week, and we had an implied 1-day-a-week play date. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, that's a good friend. And we spent a lot of time together. And then one day I was driving by her house. I had been running errands in her neighborhood, and I was driving by her house, and she was out in the front yard, so I stopped to say hi to her, and she came out to the sidewalk, and she said, what are you doing here? And I'm like, I was just stopping. I saw you. I wanted to say hi. She goes, you can't be here right now. So, oh, okay. She said, I'm having something delivered. I'm like, is it heroin? I didn't really say that. And I said, oh, okay. I left. All right. And then she texted me later. I'm sorry. I was having a washer dryer delivered. I'm like, was there heroin in the dryer? Like, I don't understand. But she was a person that really, I came to understand that she really had to deal with people when she was ready in controlled environments. She had to put the mask on before she could see me. Me showing up when she didn't know was not okay with her. There was another time when we were going for a walk, and our kids were both in school, and I called and wanted to know, are we going for a cute walk or a sweaty walk? So, like, are we exercising or are we getting into our real clothes? And so I called her house, and her husband answered, and I said, what is Leslie wearing? And he's like, well, that's a weird thing for you to ask. I'm like, because she wasn't home. And I said, oh, no, we're going for a walk. Is she wearing her sweats? Are we dressed up? And he's like, she's wearing jeans. So I show up to see her, and she was furious. She said, why did you call my house? I'm like, I don't understand the question. She's like, my husband did not know I was spending time with you today. He thought I had all these other projects in the house he wanted me to finish first, and I didn't tell him, and now you got me in trouble. So please don't call my house again. Just call my cell phone. This was so long ago, she had a house phone. And I'm like, I don't think this is going to work for me. Do you see what I'm saying? And like, this woman was in pain. She was raised in a really dysfunctional alcoholic family structure. And so as the adult child of an alcoholic, one of the things that people struggle with in that environment is I have to be a different person with different people. And she just hadn't learned to integrate. And she didn't tell people the truth. And that did not work for me. It did not work for me. So those are some examples of how we want to act truthfully. We also want to speak truthfully. So it doesn't just mean that you answer questions honestly, which can be hard enough, but like, what'd you do last night? And you don't say, oh, I read my Bible and went to the gym, when you really like ate a Twinkie and watched 4 episodes of The Crown, you know? I love that show. I can't wait for the new episode so I can not get off my couch. But can we also ask honest questions? Women, I'm sorry to say, we can be slightly manipulative without realizing it, and we can be indirect about what we ask for. It's very risky to ask for what you want, honestly. If it's your birthday and you want people to be there for you, can you say, hey, I want to go out for dinner for my birthday? Do you ask them this way? Do you say, hey, it's my birthday and it's no big deal because I know you're super busy and sitters are expensive and everything's fine and you don't have to come if you don't want to, but here's where we're going to be and if you're late, it's fine. Have you ever had someone ask you something like that and then you don't show up because they told you it wasn't important and then they're mad that you didn't know that they meant you were really supposed to be there? Can we ask honest questions? Can we say, my birthday, I'm kind of one of those people that I really like my birthday, will you come to my dinner? Don't bring a present, I'm being honest about that. And if they say no, it's okay. They told you an honest no. Can we communicate really directly? That's very scary. Because if someone says no to you when you've told them what you really want, it can hurt more if you gave them the manipulative, I don't really want it. But let's try it, shall we? Honest people share their struggles. They don't pretend like everything's okay. I think we're getting better at that as a culture, women, aren't we? Don't you think moms, especially in MOPS, we're getting better at that? Like, yeah, my Instagram posts are a combination of, aren't they beautiful and they are driving me crazy? I mean, like, that is a good thing. And then honest means that we avoid keeping secrets from our closest friends. So if you've got like your inner three, most people have like, you know, if you were going to get married today, who would be your bridesmaids? You know, those girls who would wear the matching dress and stand next to you at a major thing in your life. Those women need to know the big stuff. If you are married, your best friend should know the central conflict in your marriage. Do you know what I'm talking about? Do you have one? I'm like, the fight that you have is always like kind of about the same thing. Like he never helps with the dishes, or he works way too much, or he makes you go places with his mom you don't want to go, whatever. The thing that you always are fighting about, your best friend should know that, because that way she can help you process and she's close to you. If you have a chronic illness or someone in your family does, someone should know that. If your mom is struggling with cancer, your best friend should know. If you're having financial issues, your best friend should know that, because then you get to be honest. When she invites you out to dinner and a movie, can you say, we're on a budget, we can't afford that right now? That's real transparency. That's really important. And then, I know this is in church, but if there's an addiction in your family, Christians struggle with addiction. They struggle with gambling and alcoholism and pornography addictions. I work in the 12-step ministry at my church. And if you are going through something like that, or someone in your family is, your best friend needs to know that, because hiding it will take up a lot of energy, and you can't be a loving person when you're hiding. And you can't receive love when you're hiding. Now, I'm not suggesting if you have one of those like big secrets in your life that you haven't shared, you don't have to drop that bomb today during discussion, because I don't want you to get hurt by people not knowing what to do with it. But if you're struggling right now, you're just like, oh God, there's something going on and nobody knows about it, reach out to one of your leaders or your mentor moms or a pastor here. Start talking to somebody about that safely, because that stuff will really hinder our friendships. So why is it so important? Next slide. Why is it so important that we share our struggles, big and small? Like, what's in it for you? So much good stuff is in it for you. The first thing is exposing your issues. I mean, like, wasn't it just when you shared, like, the stuff you're going through, like, so many of us just went, oh, what a relief. I'm not a weirdo, you know? It helps us to feel known and takes away our fear of being unknown. Everyone is afraid that we won't be liked, and the only way to know if people like you is to tell them the truth and see if they run screaming from the room. There's no way to get over it other than that. You can't build confidence in a vacuum. You just have to share your real self. The second thing is it allows you to feel normal. I join MOPS for the Me Toos. Right? It just helps you know mothering is hard for everyone, marriage is hard for everyone, keeping the house clean even if you don't have a job is hard for everyone, right? Like, it just helps us feel normal. It helps us to not be so hard on ourselves. It's just good to be in a community, and to have community means like have things in common. It's really important. And then also really important is it lets us know and helps us feel supported when we are not normal. What do I mean by that? So I was in MOPS for 8 years, and by the eighth year, you can start getting a little smug, you know, because, like, you've potty trained, and you've got the kids to preschool, and it's time to retire from MOPS at that point, because you're being less sympathetic to the brand new mom who can't figure out how to do things, and then you become a MOPS speaker. But so on my last year, we have a rule at our MOPS group that's no advice giving. Do you guys have that rule here? Nobody has that but us. Let me tell you why it's good. We give no unsolicited advice at our MOPS group. So we can ask for advice, but when you're in a group of women and you share something you're struggling with, it can be like throwing feed down in front of chickens, and everyone starts going with advice. Do this, or try that. So we have like we don't share advice unless someone asks for it. So we had this young mama who came in, and she said, I'm really having a problem, and I really need advice. We're like, okay, yay, we love to give advice. Let us. And she said, I can't get my 18-month-old to sit in the high chair for longer than 15 minutes, and I don't know what to do. You should call Stanford, because your child is a genius. You can get your 18-month-old to sit in a high chair for 15 minutes? That's amazing. That's amazing. She's like, she was reading all the books about like your kids will stay out of jail and off drugs if you have family dinners and you do high lows. We're like, girl, that's not for when they're 18 months old. Throw some Cheerios on the floor and just talk to your husband. Like, they're fine. I never did that. But so we were able to say to her, that expectation you have is not normal. That's not normal. When my daughter was four, I thought she was a sociopath. And I came to moms and I'm like, I think Sophia might be a sociopath. And they're like, oh God, why? And I'm like, well, because even if I cry, she won't put her shoes on. I've done a lot of therapy since then, but in my family, my mom didn't have a lot of boundaries, so the way she got us to obey was she emotionally manipulated us, and I'm sorry to have to say that, but so I thought that if my daughter could see it was important to me that she would do it. Four-year-olds don't care about you like that. She's not a sociopath. She's normal. And I was not normal. And that was very helpful, so I can go talk to a professional. And then in a more serious example, my friend Alyssa, who was in our MOPS group, her son was really struggling with temper tantrums, and she would share just enough of what was happening for the Me Too, so people could say, yeah, you know, three-year-olds, tantrums with scientific workability, right? Like, they have the intellect to, like, do it on purpose and, you know, to break you down. Sorry if you don't have a three-year-old yet. I'm sorry to tell you. Three-year-olds can be tricky. But then she started to share the whole breadth of what she was really experiencing, how often he was having temper tantrums, what triggered them, and the duration of them, and then actually that he had hurt her baby in the process. And we were able to lean in and say, without judgment, sweetie, that sounds off the normal spectrum, and we think you should talk to your pediatrician about what's going on for him. It sounds like he's really struggling. It turned out that her son was on the autism spectrum. And until she shared what was really going on, she thought she just was kind of not a very good mom. Like, she was just losing patience with his atypical behavior and thinking it was the same as everybody else. And so she was able to get support and learn how to help her son. And then she started a support group for other moms who had children with special needs or were on the autism spectrum, because she said, I don't want anybody to ever feel as alone as I did. And so that all came from sharing the real stuff and for us to be able to reflect back to her what her reality was. Next slide. So to have safe friends, which we want, everybody like, yeah, that sounds good. I would like that. The first thing we have to do is we have to be them. We have to learn how to be safe, truthful friends, because the healthier you are, the healthier you will draw people to yourself. You will just learn, once you can be honest, you will start being able to recognize it better. My husband and I have a conflict over the way I bake cookies. He thinks my cookies are flawed. And one day he found this in my Betty Crocker cookbook, and we were just cracking up over it. It said here that chocolate chip cookies, these ones, this is what mine look like, they're too flat. And it says, Betty tells me that it's because my butter is too soft. That will make my cookies flat. Over here, we have the rounded cookie. It says that the cookie has been over-measured. The flour's been over-measured. I don't know what that means. But my favorite is in the middle. It says, chocolate chip cookies are slightly rounded. There are no problems with this cookie. You see before you a cookie without issues. And the thing is, you might be able to make a perfect cookie, but you won't find a perfect friend. So here are my four steps I want to give you today on how to be a safer, sane friend, a safer, truthful friend. And the first is that you need to admit that you have issues to yourself. Just as you're sitting there, like, God loves you, and not everything you do is art. You have issues. Second, we need to admit that we have issues to others. And we're going to practice. I want you to turn to the person next to you and say either, I have issues, or this cookie has problems. Just go ahead. Just do it right now. Tell the person next to you. Should we just quit now? Should I sit down? It's always dangerous to let you talk to each other. Step three is that we do have to accept other people have issues. You will not find a perfect woman. I wrote a bonus chapter for my book that if you pre-order, that will come to you in on your email, but it's called Giving Up the Ghost, and it's about not ghosting people. And I did a lot of research. You guys know what ghosting is, when you just don't like someone, you just stop talking to them and you disappear and they're left to wonder what the heck happened. So I talk about how to get out of relationships without being that brutal and unkind. Some of you are still talking about your issues. And in my research, I found that there's two models for relationships. They talk about in Psychology Today, there's the soulmate model and the growth model. And the soulmate model in dating, they believe, you know, there's one soulmate out there for me. So if I find someone that I have conflict with, you know what, it's just not meant to be. And those people are most likely to ghost because it's not going to work out. So I just don't need to ever call you back. And then over here is the growth model, which believes that all relationships are going to have struggles. And so before I leave, I need to try to work it out. I stand strongly on the growth model, that we need to try to work it out. Because everybody has issues. And there'll be a point where you realize something about a friend that isn't your favorite thing in the world about them. Do you run or do you wait and see how that plays out? And in the step four is to have real relationships with real women, imperfect women that last, next slide, is we need to stop trying to figure out whose issues are worse. We need to stop trying to figure out whose issues are worse. Who's messed up, me or you? It's got to be one of us. Jesus said something really brilliant about this, being Jesus. He said, "Judge not or you too shall be judged, for the measure of judgment that you use against others will be measured to you. Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your eye? How can you say to your brother, 'Let me take the speck out of your eye,' when all the time there's a plank in your own eye? You hypocrite, first take the plank out of your own eye and then you can see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's." I think sometimes I miss how funny Jesus is, because this is actually a humorous picture. If I'm standing up here and you all have a 2x4 sticking out of your left eye, and you're trying to get the eyelash off the girl next to you, you're literally like whacking each other in the head with your issues, you know? And you've probably known people that are so unaware of their own stuff that they just go through life like just bulldozing people and telling them all the things about them that are really talking about themselves. It's not pretty. Now, Jesus is not saying you're always the one with the bigger problem. It's always you. You got a plank. Everybody else is fine. That's not possible. But what he is saying is, deal with your own stuff. Your stuff is your stuff. And let other people handle their own stuff. Casey Musgraves says it like this: mind your own biscuits and life will be gravy. Sometimes I sing that. I'm not going to today. Our issues are ours to deal with God and in safe relationships through self-awareness and answering things. Self-awareness is the most important thing you bring to your relationships, to be able to look at yourself in the mirror and even ask the brave question of your friends, tell me the truth. Whose fault is this right now? Like if you're raging against your husband, do you have a friend that you can say, tell me the truth, is this me or him? Do you have someone like that? I grew up with a fixer model of friendships. My mom was the middle child of 6 kids, and all of her siblings called her, and she gave them advice, but she didn't tell anybody what she needed. So I went into my life thinking, that's how relationships work. If I'm very blessed, I find someone less blessed than me and take care of them. That did not go well. Or I find someone more blessed than me and ask them to take care of me. And so I was always wondering, like, which one am I? Are you here to fix me or am I here to fix you? Because that's what relationships were to me. 4 years ago, I started going to Codependence Anonymous, a 12-step group that helps people like me who believe that you only love me if I have something to offer you. You love me if you need me. So you can ask me for lots of favors and I will help you, help you, help you, help you, and I need love in return. And that didn't go very well for me because nobody wants to be your project. I mean, some people do. Those are toxic relationships and you need to get out of those. But learning to come in with mutual beneficiality instead of I'm here to help you and figure out whose issues are worse is not a healthy model for relationships. The next slide. Here's the other thing that I want us to get from this passage of scripture, and that is when we judge too quickly or too harshly, we begin to fear the same standard will be applied to us, and it will. If you go out in the world judging, you get judgment. If you go out into the world with grace, you get grace. Have you ever been the mom whose kid was the worst kid at the playdate? How many of you have had the worst kid at the playdate? Raise your hand. Okay, like he bit somebody or threw something. My daughter once pushed a kid into the lake. I had times where I had to pick up my daughter like surfboard style. You know, you don't even say goodbye. You just wave. You're like, we're done. They're screaming. They're writhing. Now, if you're sitting on the bench going, I don't know if Sophia's really an appropriate friend for Johnny. Look at that bad behavior. Mom obviously hasn't learned to control her. She pushes people into the lake. when it's your turn to be the mom with the bad kid at the play date, and your turn will come, you start to believe that everyone's about to write you off. It's this crazy thing. If I'm quick to write you off, I think you're quick to write me off. And then we all start hiding and image managing. And if we can just like give grace, then we're all going to feel a little bit safer. The most unhappy people are judgmental people and critical people. They either become unhappy because of how critical they are, or they criticize because they're so unhappy. However, I am not telling you not to be discerning in your relationships. There's a difference between being judgmental and being discerning. If you see the signs of unsafeness in friends, you are allowed to get out. Proverbs 13:20 says, "Walk with the wise and become wise, associate with fools and get into trouble." And that is something you're going to teach your kids as they get older, especially when they're in high school like mine. I don't care if you're not drinking. If everyone at the party is drinking and the cops show up, you're all in trouble. So associate with wise people to stay out of trouble. So the key for me to knowing the difference between being judgmental and using good judgment is look for the fruit of wisdom in the people's lives that you hang out with. A huge part of my book that I really hope you'll pre-order before I leave today. A huge part of my book is, what does the Bible say about what wise character looks like? What does wisdom look like? And people who are wise are the people we want close to us. We want to become wise by being with wise people. Some of the freedom, next slide please, some of the freedom from the plank versus spec dilemma, I think, the idea of that we're judging and comparing each other, is that we have to try to avoid competition and comparison. And I think competition and comparison, which we all struggle with at different points in our life, comes from really that we're afraid of our differences. We're afraid that maybe there's only one right answer to parenting, or one right answer to being a wife, one right answer to life. And if someone else is doing it differently, then it means that we're doing it wrong. Can anyone relate to that? I read Baby Wise as a young mom, and so I was like a sleep Nazi. And I just felt like I needed to help everybody else be a sleep Nazi with me. Because if you were being an attachment style parent, then maybe I was wrong. So I'm just going to convert you all. It'd be much, much easier for me if you would all just do it exactly like me. I learned how to stop this in MOPS and with some of my great relationships. I want to tell you a little story. One of my friends, we're going to call her Sue. She's not one of my Jane. Actually, let's call her Jane. Let's just make her Jay. My friend Jane used to say that she doesn't cook. She prepares food. Anybody know what that means? She goes to Trader Joe's and buys things and she heats it up. Okay, so she's not a cooker, she's a food preparer. Now, I love to cook. It's one of the things, especially before I was working as much as I'm working now, that kind of gave me a sense of creativity and accomplishment was to cook. And so she felt a little insecure about the fact that I was a little bit of a domestic diva and she was like a microwaver. Now, I didn't care. I'm happy to have a microwaver as a friend. But for her, it was a little bit of a sensitive issue. And I forgot that. And one night, she called me and I was feeling like really good about myself as a housewife because I'd had a very satisfying domestic experience. I had opened my refrigerator and found different ingredients and made something up for dinner. And so she called me right as I was serving dinner and I said, "Guess what? I made homemade tortellini soup with organic Swiss chard I bought from the farmer's market." I bought the tortellini at Trader Joe's. I'm not that good. And she goes, "Great, my kids had frozen pizza for dinner." And I'm like, "Well, frozen pizza's fine, that's good, it's fine, you know." But she's sounded a little bitter. In the meantime, I've served my family dinner, and my husband is in the middle, and my kids are on either side. And I told them, "I have to go take this phone call, it's important, I'll be back." And as I'm leaving, they all are, like, put their finger up, and they're like, "Waiter." And I just love that. That has not changed, that I could be on the toilet, juggling flaming knives, talking on the phone, and the kids will walk right by their father, who's doing nothing, to ask me for something. So I was kind of irritated. I'm like, "The Parmesan cheese is in the fridge. Your dad, the other adult that lives here, is right there, and I'll be right back." But my daughter, who was 8, says, "There's a bug in my soup." And I'm like, "Oh." So I look, and there's a little gnat in her soup. So I pick it out, and I flick it, and I say, "It's like protein. It's fine. I'll be right back. Have dinner." And I walk in the living room, and I finish my conversation, and I come back in, and at the heart of my home, the kitchen table, there's a problem. My 4-year-old is eating fine. My husband is eating, but he's eating like this. And my 7-year-old is crying.
I can't eat this. There's too many bugs in it.
I'm like, what are you talking about, honey? It's fresh ground pepper. Like, it's pepper. And my husband leans across the table and says, the pepper has legs. I look in my bowl. So organic Swiss chard from the farmer's market. There's a lot of bugs in that stuff. You have to wash that really well. I had washed it, but not well enough, and there were dozens of tiny gnats in the soup. And my four-year-old, who won't eat anything as, like, you know, exotic as oregano, goes, I like it. I just picked the bugs out. She ate the whole bowl. So as my husband drove off to Carl's Jr., I called my friend, Jane, and I said, well, your kids got frozen pizza, but I force-fed mine bugs. And not only that, apparently there's something going on in my marriage because my husband doesn't feel he has the authority to tell the children they don't have to eat the bug-laced soup. I'm so scary that he had to eat it too. He ate the bugs. We're still trying to get to the bottom of that one. So it's lovely that I called her back and let her know. This is one of those examples of sharing our struggles and letting people know where we blow it, because it made her feel better. And I want to say something about that friendship. Jane and I were really different. We served in MOPS together, and sometimes she would just drive me crazy because I'm a hustler and I move really fast and I get a lot of stuff done. And she just, like, talks to people and looks them in the eye and stuff. It's so irritating because I needed her to hustle and get things done faster. But you know what she taught me? She taught me to sit down and be present with my kids. She was really good at that. She microwaves food, but she talks to her children. And when I spent time with her, I learned to be more still. And we would have great times on the floor with our kids together. And I taught her how to bake cupcakes, and she didn't take to it, and I just made all the cakes for her kids' birthdays from then on. But still, I think the example stands. Now, I said, I'm in Codependence Anonymous, which is a 12-step group, and in it, we have a thing called getting a sponsor. Like you've probably seen on TV, people in AA have a sponsor. I have a sponsor. And what we do is, it says in our literature, if you see something in someone you want, ask them to be your sponsor. What if friendship worked like that? What if you see something that someone has that you want, and instead you're like, dang it, she's too pretty, too perfect, too organized, too calm. I don't want to be anywhere near her. You want to be near people who have those great qualities because they can teach you some stuff. And they can encourage you to do some things that you don't know how to do. And then you can encourage and teach them how to do things that they don't know how to do. And that brings me to our next slide, and the last part of what makes us safe people is that safe friends are able to both give and take from the relationship. You have something to offer in every relationship you're in. If you're in a relationship where you feel like the other person doesn't need you and you don't have anything to give them, then you need to have that conversation. And here's why. Cloudon Townsend, who wrote the book Safe People and also all the Boundaries books, which if you need a butt kicking, you should read the book Boundaries. This is one of the best Christian books that's ever been written. In my humble opinion, I teach it a lot. They say the number one quality of an unsafe person is someone who won't admit that they need anything from the relationship. Isn't that kind of shocking? It's not controlling people. It's not dishonest people. It's not mean people. They say someone who won't admit that they need you is an unsafe person. And they say this is why. Because what you're implying is, I have what you need, and I don't really respect you. Now, none of us mean to do that, I would guarantee. How many of you are more comfortable helping someone than asking for help? You'd rather give than take. How many of you are more comfortable taking than giving? The takers never raise their hands. Most of us don't want to ask for help unless we know the day and time we can pay somebody back, right? It makes us feel really, really uncomfortable to ask for help. But I'm not a safe friend if I can't admit that I need help. Receiving your confidences and I don't share mine, I'm not safe if I can't share my own struggles with you. And the next slide. And that's because pretending you have it all together makes other people feel that they are falling apart by comparison. Because I compare my insides to your outsides, and your outsides look pretty good. I have my friend Jen, who I have her permission to tell this story. There was a time in our friendship 10 years ago, her husband was having an affair, and it was a long-term affair, and she was really struggling with what to do. Like, he kind of wanted to stay married and keep his girlfriend. And we called him the dirtbag, or DB for short, and some other words, and that was how we talked about him. And it was a very upsetting time, and it was mostly what we talked about when we talked to each other was like, what is she going to do? Does she make him leave? Does she do this? What counseling does she, what is she going to do? She had two young sons at the time. And in that time, I did not talk to her about my problems. I just figured she had got enough going on, right? And like, I just did not call, she wasn't the friend I called in trouble at that time. And then one day, I had a terrible fight with my mother-in-law, with whom I have fully made up. It was a long time ago. And I called her in hysterics, like hysterical. And she said, I'll come right over. And then she checked on me for days, and we talked about it and processed it, and she prayed for me, and she was such a good friend to me. And a week later, she called me, and she said, I need to thank you. Like, for what? She said, I was beginning to think that you thought I was too broken to help you. So thank you for trusting me and asking me for help. I didn't think, that's not what I thought. I just thought she had enough going on. I have another good friend who has rheumatoid arthritis, which is a really painful, deliberating, you know, chronic disease. And when we first made friends, I never asked her for help because I'm like, she's in pain all the time. I'm not going to ask her for help. But she wanted to reciprocate. I babysit her kids. She babysits mine. She wants to feel like a valuable person, and she is. So I just want to remind you that you actually bless people when you ask them for help. Because what you're saying is, I think you're valuable. I think you have something. I need something that you have. You're worthwhile. So I want to challenge you today. Ask for help. You will bless people by letting them know that you think that they're worthwhile, that you think they have attributes that you need, or even a car with a seat, you know, with a car seat in it, and you appreciate that about them, and they can pick up your kid. I want to close with these last couple thoughts, and that is that sometimes our personality, our issues are not our personality flaws or our fears or our OCD or whatever, but there are circumstances. Sometimes our friend's issues are just, they're going through a difficult time. And I love that this verse in Proverbs, that a friend loves at all times, and a brother is born to help in time of need. Your closest girlfriends, they need you sometimes to just be there with them in their stuff. I bet you are pretty good at that. I think most women are pretty good at that. It says on your outline that you will sometimes be held back in order to hold someone's hand, which is just another way of saying that authentic friendship takes sacrifice. There are times that we have to take the great risk to put someone else's needs above our own, to enter into their pain with them, to be there with them when they're struggling, and to just listen. The Bible talks about a concept called sitting Shiva. It comes from Job. Shiva literally means 7 days, and in Job, when Job was like covered in boils and all his family had died, his friends just came and they sat on the ground with him for 7 days. And the Jews still do this when someone dies. People will come and just sit with you. And our culture's not that great at just sitting with people when they're sad. We tend to want to cheer people up. But what a lot of people need is just for you to sit and let them be upset. Jill and I were talking about the movie Inside Out, which I talk about in my book, that if we try to get rid of sadness, we also lose joy, and anger, fear, and disgust take over. So if we can be courageous and sit with people when they're sad without trying to make them get over it, that's one of the best things you can do for friends. And our culture is not very good at that. And we don't say things like, God is good, and God only gives this to you because he gives you as much as you can handle. Don't ever say that to anybody. Don't ever say that to anybody, because you know what? God gives us all kinds of stuff we can't handle, and then he is big enough for us. And that's basically like we're trying to make sense of other people's tragedy. Don't try to make sense of it for them. Just sit with them. Let's go back to the bug soup for a minute. The reason I was on the phone with Jane while my kids were eating dinner, which we've clearly learned is a bad idea for me, was that Jane had been going through a really difficult time. When her son was 20 months old, she called me on a Sunday night and said, I think Grayson has a hernia. I'm changing his diaper and something looks wrong down there. And I said, well, take him to the pediatrician and let me know what happens. By Thursday, we were together in Chalk Hospital and he was having surgery. And I was sitting with her when the doctor came out and said, your son has testicular cancer. Now, this, Grayson's fine, happy ending. But that was like one of the worst moments of my life, was sitting in the hospital to hear your 20-month-old has cancer. And she was pregnant at the time, and we walked through some really dark stuff she was going through, like this idea that what if God's giving me this baby because he's taking that, you know, he's going to take that baby, and I don't want this one to replace that one. That's not going to work for me. And like, I just had to sit with her in that, and it was really hard. But I want to remind you that a network of safe, sane friends is what you need, more than one, because you can sit shiva with someone who's really suffering, and then you're allowed to go see a romantic comedy with your friend that night because you need support too. If we have a network and it's not just a one-on-one thing, then we are better equipped to take care of people in suffering because we have people to support us. In the last 10 years, my girlfriends and I have been through some crap, man. Can I say crap in church? I already have several times, so it's too late now. Next slide. This is my friend Josie. She was my college roommate, and she went to Ukraine for 10 years, and we're still really close. She was a missionary. And this is my friend Jen, whose husband was the dirtbag. We've been through a lot. Josie lost two children in stillborn births. Jenny's husband had an affair. My other friends, we've had deaths of grandparents and parents and siblings. We've had downturns of businesses and lost homes. We've had diagnoses of dangerous illnesses. We struggle with depression. There's been all kinds of stuff. But we also have seen God show up and be faithful. I celebrate Grayson's birthday like nothing. The day that she called, the bug soup day, he had had his 1 year cancer-free appointment at the oncologist, and I celebrated that so much that I made my kids eat gnats. Josie has three beautiful, healthy sons, and she now speaks to MOPS groups about how to help people who are struggling with miscarriages, and I've seen God bring great fruit out of her life because of that. And Jen, her husband, the dirtbag, broke up with his girlfriend, went to a 12-step recovery for intimacy disorders, and fully repented. And she fully forgave him, which is a miracle. And they've been married for 22 years. The dirtbag bought her an airline ticket to fly cross-country to go to MomCon with me when I gave this talk to MomCon. And he gave me his blessing to tell the story because he's like, I want other people to know that it's possible to heal from something like this. And isn't that amazing? So there have been times that I was tempted to give up and move on from some of these friendships, but I'm really glad I did it, and I want to encourage you to stay in there in the hard stuff because the benefit so outweighs it. And I'd love to pray for you before we close, and I want you to ask you to close your eyes, and I'm going to ask you a question to be a little bit vulnerable today, so everyone has to close their eyes or the game's not fair. You don't have to pray, but you do have to close your eyes. If you're in a situation right now where you're just really not sure if one of your friends is a safe relationship or not, and you're really struggling with that, and you need some wisdom and discernment about whether it's time for you to step out of that relationship, would you just raise your hand, because I'd love to pray for you today? And then if you're just struggling with loneliness, you're just not feeling connected, or you're not feeling like you can be authentic, would you just raise your hand for that too? And I want to pray for you. Okay? Thanks. Father God, I thank you that in James you promise that you give wisdom to all of us who ask without finding fault. So we ask that you would pour the blessing of wisdom and discernment out on the moms today who are struggling with a relationship. We've been hurt in the past, Lord, and sometimes it makes it difficult for us to discern when someone is being unkind to us and we need to leave. So would you please give us good boundaries today, wisdom and support. And Lord, for those of us who are struggling with deep secrets or pain or inauthenticity or wondering if people would really want to connect with us as we are, God, pour out again your comfort and blessing. Let this be a place where we begin to heal those wounds. I thank you for MOPS and its great ministry that we are together. We come to feel normal and known. And I thank you how much you love each woman in this room. Give them grace this morning. In Jesus' name, amen.